This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch is diving into the affairs of the MBTA again. This is the T struggles to meet safety mandates that were imposed by the federal government. We spoke to Congressman Lynch this morning to get an update, and we started by asking him why he's getting so hands-on again now.
Well, considering the amount of money, first of all, I'm the senior member from New England on the Transportation Committee, so I had a key role in providing resources to the MBTA and to the Commonwealth for transportation. So just wanted to make sure that the money was spent properly and that the MBTA was handling in the best way under difficult circumstances.
So to remind our listeners, last year when you got involved, it was budget season. Federal government had earmarked, you know, well, close to $900 million for the T. And then there was discussion of layoffs and service cuts. You intervened directly. What was the pain point you were most concerned about this year, Congressman?
Well, it dealt more with the concerns that the Federal Transit Administration was dealing with. We had a number of accidents, some of them, you know, devastating accidents on the MBTA where, you know, passengers were injured, severely injured, and we had a number of derailments. So the FTA came in and did an investigation of all those accidents. And that was very troubling given the fact that we had given considerable funds to the MBTA to avoid that. As it happens, the FTA investigation talked about the huge amount of overtime that is being spent by you know, train dispatchers and personnel on the T, and they felt that those long shifts, some as many as 20-hour shifts, that was contributing to the incidents occurring because workers were overtired. And so that they recommended to the MBTA that they cut back on the number of trains in order that those workers wouldn't work such long shifts. So we had to focus on that. And it was a shift in what we were doing. But, you know, it required me to get directly involved, not only with the MBTA and with the governor, but also with the unions that represent those employees as well.
So the FTA started its work in April. That's the Federal Transit Administration. They came up with four early recommendations. The staffing and fatigue of dispatchers was part of it. You talked about the union piece of this. I'm going to note that we reached out to the MBTA to join us. We invited Steve Poftek to join us. They declined, but they sent us a statement that read in part, quote, because the MBTA's Director of Labor Relations is in active negotiations with the unions, the MBTA does not feel it would be helpful at this stage to make any public comments about the ongoing discussions, end quote. What can you tell us about the focus of those discussions and whether you feel both sides are making progress?
Well, here's the deal. Because of COVID, we've had a lot of people retired from the MBTA, and by their own admission, they have not created a reserve body of employees to take over, for instance, the dispatching and coordination of the train flow, much similar to air traffic controls, except we're dealing with trains here. So we met with the union, we met with the MBTA leadership, and we tried to devise a way where some of the dispatchers who had retired could come back on the payroll without suffering any ill effects on their pensions.
Those but people come with, back, with recent retirement, right? So they're still sort of trained
exactly,
up.
Exactly. So you know, it takes about 4 months to train a dispatcher. They usually come from the crew of conductors who are actually driving the trains. Those people have the best perspective. And so because it was a position where we felt it was unsafe to continue to operate as we had been, we decided that we would make an effort to bring some of these conductors back, excuse me, the dispatchers back onto the payroll, but not penalize them as normally would have happen under the union contract and the union pension agreement.
We're talking with Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch about latest developments with the MBTA and safety considerations. Congressman, do you feel right now today that the T is safe?
I do, because we've cut back. So we are not running in optimum efficiency here, where we have slowed down the flow of trains. We've slowed down the frequency of these trips so that these workers are not working the long, you know, double shifts, 16, 18, 20 hours continuously in those positions. So I believe it's safe, much safer than it had been.
But as I understand you, what you're also saying is that the T is not in a position to be able to run both efficiently and safely at the same time.
That's correct. I think that's a good assessment, yeah.
So I'm going to play a little sound from Steve Pofdek at the end of last month. He's the general manager of the MBTA. Regarding how hard this has all been on riders, this is courtesy of WCVB.
I viscerally understand how frustrating it can be.
Are your constituents frustrated? What are you hearing from them?
They are. I'll just give you an example. So because of the cutback in service, trains are arriving, say, 4 minutes later than they or there's a greater gap of about 4 minutes between a train arriving. In that 4 minutes, if you ride the T, you know, especially during the rush hours in the morning and in the evenings, the station just fills up. And so in many cases, I've heard from my constituents that they've got to wait for several trains to go by before there's room enough for them to get on the train. So that's deeply frustrating to the people that I work for.
So that's such an interesting tension too, Congressman. Last year, one of the things that you were worried about was ridership. We know the T has not recovered the ridership that it had prior to the pandemic and that it relies on revenues, certainly nowhere near the ridership it needs long term. What do you think it's going to take? I mean, there's almost a chicken and an egg here, right? You got to have a better T in order to get more riders, but you need more riders for revenue for a better T. How do you see this working out?
Well, fortunately, in the Jobs and Infrastructure Act, we gave about $9.5 billion to Massachusetts for dealing with this exact problem. The $9.5 billion is over 5 years, but it allows the MBTA, despite the fact that we have low ridership right now, to put a plan in place to buy, I think the administration, the Baker administration has committed, I think, $900 million to buying new train sets and vehicles for the T. They've put in, I think, $600 million for trains signaling and just different technology to make it easier to run the trains in a more expedient fashion. So they have earmarked a lot of that money to improving the system. And that's the key here, right? If we want people to use the MBTA, and that's really a key task here, to get cars off the road and help the environment, but also make Eastern Massachusetts, make the MBTA work again. We've got to give them an experience that is enjoyable and that is efficient. And so all of that money, plus the $2 billion that we gave to the MBTA directly in the CARES Act, is really targeted and intended to accomplish that goal.
Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch with us on the MBTA. And of course, then word sort of late last night that the state legislature has earmarked another $266 million for the T to address results of the current FTA recommendations. They should vote on that. It's expected today. Is that enough?
I'm not sure. I know there's statutorily we have a cost sharing formula with the state. So the feds and the state, we sort of match up. I know they're doing their best. I know that I did speak to Speaker Ron Mariano. I did speak again with the governor. So and all of our legislators, I had a chance to meet up at the Senate with them as well. And they seem to think so. So I trust their judgment on that.
I'm going to play another piece of sound for you. MBTA General Manager Steve Pofdek has had both strong supporters and strong detractors, especially over the last year or year and a half. He was at a press conference on July 14th. The sound I'm about to play you is courtesy of WCVB, and somebody asked him his reaction to calls for his resignation. Here he is.
I feel that I am doing the right thing, leading the T. I feel that I am equipped to lead this organization. I understand what needs to be done.
Do you agree?
Well, I think he's had a mixed, record. I do think that there has been some oversight of key issues. As I mentioned before, the number of reserve employees that would be available to direct the trains, the dispatchers, he's taken ownership of that though. And in fairness to him, with the pandemic, it was very difficult to figure out how many MBTA employees were actually going to come back onto the payroll, how many were not. So it's been a moving target for him. So I don't want to put all the blame on him. I will say to his credit that he's been open and accessible, and we've had some difficult conversations, but we've made some progress as well.
All right, last question. We've got about 30 seconds. The state legislature is holding hearings on the MBTA today. Do you feel that they're doing their jobs on oversight and funding?
I do. I know that they share my frustration on a lot of these issues. Aaron Michalowicz over at Ways and Means has been a real champion, trying to get the resources to address these shortfalls in ridership and performance. So I think we're a good team.
Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch of the 8th District there. The state legislature is holding hearings on the MBTA today, but that's not all. There's a lot still on the table with less than 2 weeks to go in the legislative session. I think $50 billion state budget, a $3.8 billion economic development package, a reproductive rights bill, and there's more. Here to break it all down for us, WBUR senior state house reporter Steve Brown is with us again. Welcome back, Steve.
Hey, Tiziana.
So let's start with the reproductive rights bill, Steve. I know the House and the Senate each passed their own version. They aren't quite seeing eye to eye. So where's the sticking point?
Yeah, they're actually pretty close on most of it. The sticking point is over abortions after 24 weeks and the word severe. When the legislature approved the Roe Act last session, codifying the state's laws pertaining to abortion, they stated that abortions after 24 weeks of pregnancy is allowed to save the life of the mother or if the doctor determines a fatal fetal anomaly, meaning the fetus would not be able to survive on its own outside the womb. Now, this session, the House expanded that to include a severe fetal anomaly, which could open the door to abortions involving fetuses who would be able to survive once born, but with many, many health and developmental challenges. The Senate balked at that language, the word severe, and tried to further clarify the language of the Roe Act, but the House insisted on their version. Now, I think the House would like to deal with this once and for all right now. The Senate seems to want to get a bill to the governor that addresses all the immediate concerns caused by last month's Dobbs ruling by the Supreme Court, but they're open to revisiting further changes in the future. The Senate president last week named several senators to a reproductive rights task force, indicating that they intend to return to the issue in another session.
And, of course, the Dobbs ruling overruling the constitutional right to an abortion at the federal level. Okay, so now there is a conference committee. Talk us through the process and timeline. And I'm mindful, as you and I discussed last week, Governor Baker has 10 days to act once a bill hits his desk and the legislative session ends at the end of the month.
Right. It's about 2 weeks to go. The session does end July 31st. They really have to get this to the governor's desk ASAP. If they can get it to him before Thursday, they would have just enough time to deal with any potential vetoes. Now, remember, Governor Baker vetoed the part of the Roe Act that allowed for abortions after 24 weeks in the cases of fatal fetal anomalies. So it's a safe bet that he would have concerns about the word severe as well. Now, the votes for these bills were overwhelming in both the House and the Senate. So it's pretty clear that the legislature would override any vetoes, but they have to back time this just right to make sure that they don't run out of runway.
We've got WBUR senior state house reporter Steve Brown with us at the end of the legislative session. On this reproductive rights bill, Steve, what's the goal? Is there sort of some further enshrinement that needs to be done with the protections already in place? Is this really an attempted expansion? Explain that to us.
Yeah, it does a couple of things. It puts into law protections for Massachusetts providers from out-of-state laws. Now, remember, those new laws in Texas and Oklahoma try to extend beyond their borders. Say if a resident from one of those states were to come here for an abortion, this law states that those laws from other states do not apply here. I think that's the main goal. It also seeks to further clarify that abortion services remain legal here in Massachusetts.
So that's just one bill, Steve. Then we've got the budget. We saw a compromise plan emerge last night. $53 million budget. Could be action on that today. So what is the latest? What do you think is going to happen today?
Yeah, the budget is on a glide path for passage and should be on Governor Baker's desk by the end of the day today. Getting back to the veto concern I just talked about in regards to the reproductive rights bill, there will be enough time at the end, the very end of the session, to take up override votes, assuming that the governor does issue some. The House and the Senate today will accept the compromise. They cannot make any changes to it, so it'll be passed today.
And $53 billion is a lot of money, Steve, but is it? Is that more or less than in the past, and any notable increases or decreases?
It is a record. I believe this is for the first time that the state budget has exceeded $50 billion. The state is running a surplus, so the spigot for expenditures was wide open. For example, unrestricted local aid, that's the money that the state sends to cities and towns to do with as they see fit. The House called for increasing that aid 2.7% or $31.5 million. The Senate proposed doubling that increase. They went with the Senate version. So that means nearly $1.25 billion from the entire state budget goes to cities and towns, no strings attached. And that's in addition to the nearly $6 billion from this budget that's going to Chapter 70 school aid. So there's a lot of money in there to go out to places.
Steve, I have to say that it kind of feels like deja vu. Why does it always feel like we are down to the wire with some of this? A budget north of $50 billion, if it's a record setter. It feels like you wouldn't want to rush that at the deadline.
Yeah, this place thrives on those kind of deadlines. It creates a take-it-or-leave-it approach to negotiations. It's sort of like a legislative game of chicken. See who's going to blink first. Not just with the budget, but with all the other bills that are still up in the air. Now, to be fair, we have known what is in the House budget since April and what is in the Senate budget since May. It's just the final compromise that was released last night that requires a quick read and a hope that everything that's needed is in there.
So you're saying this is really tactical?
Yeah, I think all these bills coming to fruition at the very end, it just kind of, you know, puts a little pressure on people to, you know, hey, this is our last best offer. You better take it. Those are the kind of things that are probably going on behind closed doors in these conference committees. I believe there are 11 conference committees right now that are working on things. So it really puts the pressure on them.
I'm just trying to imagine being in a negotiation on $50 billion where you get thrown down a last best offer. All right, so $50 billion, a lot. There's also this $3.8 billion economic development package, which still a lot. Where are we on that?
Yeah, the House passed their version last week, and the Senate will tackle it this week. They pass an economic development package every 2 years, doling out additional money to various districts above and beyond what's in the state budget. Now, what's interesting about this year's economic development bill is it contains tax cuts. The House and Senate have agreed to the framework of those cuts, and many of them mirror what Governor Baker had proposed earlier this year. So it seems that they're a little less concerned about potential vetoes, so they have a little more time to finesse the final bill, but will likely not have any time at the end of the session to deal with any overrides should the governor issue any vetoes.
So much has been made of the fact that there's a $3.6 billion surplus when we talked about the tax cuts last week. A lot of pointing to that as a way to do it. How does the surplus this year affect everything we've just been talking about?
Yeah, well, you know, when each branch finished their respective budgets back in the spring, they both came in around $50 billion. Now the final version clocks in at $52.7 billion. Do the math, and that tells me that the conference committee funded a lot of priorities.
So I know you heard our conversation with Congressman Stephen Lynch. We were talking about the MBTA. There is a hearing today. Where does the MBTA fit in as Lynch tries to push them on staffing, more robust service, et cetera?
Sure. The legislature is holding an oversight hearing right now to examine the issues related to deficiencies in safety management practices at the MBTA. The legislature has oversight on things like this, so today's hearing is not surprising. Still, it's unlikely that the legislature has the bandwidth to do anything substantial about the T this session. You mentioned the extra $266 million that's included in the budget, but beyond that, I'd look to next year's session to see what they're going to do about the T.
So you are a senior state house reporter. We've just covered a range of subjects. What are the couple that you're really going to be paying attention to this week?
Sure. Can the legislature get to everything that seems to be in the pipeline, or is there a bottleneck? There are some big bills in the mix that may fall by the wayside. Sports wagering, remember that?
Yep.
That's one of them.
Actually, I kind of forgot.
it's in a conference, but at least from the outside, it seems both sides remain far apart. Same goes for the climate change and wind energy bill. We've been getting some signals that that bill might not make it this session. The House bill focused primarily on supporting the wind industry, while the Senate went much broader. If they can't reach an agreement soon, they're going to have to start from scratch next session, which begins in January.
All right, that is WBUR Senior State House reporter Steve Brown, who will keep bringing it all to us. Always great to have you on Radio Boston, Steve. Thanks for joining us.
Nice talking with you, Tiziana.
You too. A sedative that is not approved for humans may be responsible for a rise in opioid-related overdoses and deaths. It's called xylazine, and it's used by veterinarians during operations. Now, it is spreading through the illegal drug supply. And this week's From the Newsroom, WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger is here to tell us about it. Martha, welcome back.
Hi, Tiziana.
Hi, it's great to have you. So, fascinating story here. How concerned are health officials right now about this xylazine and its connection with opioid overdoses?
There are alerts going out from hospitals and a statewide drug checking program. The concern, Tiziana, is that xylazine, a sedative, is compounding the effects of fentanyl. So fentanyl is the powerful opioid already responsible for most overdose deaths in Massachusetts and across the country. Dr. Laura Keough treats patients addicted to drugs at Massachusetts General Hospital, and she's hearing a lot about xylazine from her patients.
It lowers their blood pressure and heart rate response to the respiratory depression and puts them at further risk of overdose.
And Dr. Keough is also worried about patients who report being out. They're essentially unconscious for hours on end because xylazine produces what Keough calls a profound sedation.
We're seeing people who have been sexually assaulted, they'll, you know, wake up and find that their pants are down or their clothes are missing and they are completely unaware of what happened.
And Tiziana, that increased risk of assault and injury are just some of the concerns we're hearing related to xylazine.
All right, so that is very disturbing. And then, as I understand it, xylazine also doesn't respond to naloxone, or the brand name Narcan, which is that nasal spray that can reverse an overdose.
Mm-hmm, that's right, yes, because xylazine is not an opioid. So Narcan has no effect on that sedation that Dr. Keough just described. And it won't wake somebody up, but it still can restore breathing after an opioid or fentanyl overdose. And since xylazine is often mixed with fentanyl, it's still really important to use Narcan. Here's Dr. Bill Soares, an emergency room physician. He's at Bay State Medical Center in Springfield.
If you see anyone that you suspect has an overdose, please give Narcan. But definitely I would encourage to have EMS, because if the person does not wake up as expected, they're going to need more advanced care.
And while you wait for 911, it's really important to do rescue breathing to make sure that the person gets oxygen into their brain.
So that is more than enough for this to be scary and dark, Martha. But then I understand from your reporting that there's also this question of wounds. You noted that in Philadelphia, for example, doctors are reporting more amputations among people who use drugs since xylazine has flooded the illegal drug supply there.
Yes. Clinicians say skin abscesses that come with injection drug use are deeper and more infected with xylazine. That may be because, as we heard earlier, xylazine slows blood flow, so the healing doesn't happen in the normal way. But they're not really sure because, as you said in the beginning, you know, this is not a drug that's approved for human use, so there's a lot people don't know. But what we do know is that shame plays a role here. I visited a mobile outreach team in Greenfield, which is up near the Vermont border in western Massachusetts. Nurse Katie Robbins, who works out of that team, says her patients who need advanced wound care can get same-day appointments.
They can, and they won't, because there's so much stigma and shame around wounds from injection drug use. Often people wait until they have a life-threatening infection.
So Tiziana, that might help explain why amputations are up in Philadelphia. You know, if you wait longer to get care, it's going to be harder. Doctors say that's a real warning sign for Massachusetts. And one more thing I'll mention, xylazine seems to be making it harder to connect people to treatment. That may be because treatment programs aren't ready to manage the care for these wounds. It may also be because xylazine withdrawal produces a really severe anxiety that is hard for clinicians to kind of manage while they're trying to get people into onto, you know, drugs that will help treat their opioid addiction.
So Martha, while I was reading your reporting, what kept coming up for me is why. Okay, so right now, roughly 92% of the illegal drug supply has fentanyl in it, as you've mentioned. You just talked about Greenfield, where they found xylazine in about 50% of the local drug supply in a given month. Why is somebody adding xylazine to the drug supply? Fentanyl's already there.
There is no confirmed answer, but here are a couple of possibilities. Fentanyl wears off quickly. So the deep sedation from xylazine, if added to fentanyl, might help extend a fentanyl high. It might be, you know, something that is more attractive for that reason. Xylazine is also easy to order. The illegal drug market is having some of the same supply chain issues that we're seeing with illegal drugs. So maybe xylazine is helping to fill some of those delivery or supply chain gaps. And then, Tiziana, maybe it's just something new, kind of the latest experiment in adding and mixing what people take to numb the physical and emotional pain that drives many people to drug use.
So, Martha, let's step back. You report on so many fascinating health stories. How did this one first come on your radar?
Tracy Green runs the drug checking program that partners with the state. She's at Brandeis University. And so she often kind of has her finger on the pulse of changes that are underway. And she said to me in an email exchange not too long ago, like, you need to do a xylazine story. So I Tracy's one of the many sources that I listen to when I'm trying to figure out what people need to know to kind of stay on top of things. That's basically how I got onto xylazine.
And was there a moment where you're like, I'm sorry, what? Animal tranquilizer in the illegal drug, supply, making fentanyl even worse? That, I mean, it almost reads like a fictional nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, so Tiziana, one of the conversations that came up in reporting this story is a call among many doctors for a safer drug supply. Like, they want to be able to prescribe something to their patients that they know is not cut with all of these other additives that might make their drug use much more dangerous. That's a very controversial idea, but that's where some doctors say that we need to go. And we probably need to take a deeper look at that idea sometime soon.
Well, I'll look forward to your reporting on that. Really appreciate you joining us. WBUR health reporter Martha Biebinger. Martha, as always, thank you.
Thank you for having me, Tiziana.
So that sound was marine biologist Greg Skomel of the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries showing delight after tagging a great white shark in a video captured and shared by the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy. Now, not everyone shares Greg's enthusiasm for shark-infested waters, so we caught up with him recently to talk shark encounters, and we started by asking him about this first tag of the year.
Yeah, it was our first of the season. And although, you know, media reports are pretty crazy with regard to sharks, there are not a lot of sharks off Cape Cod right now. So it was a tough day for us. We only saw three all day, and we finally got the tag in that last one later in the afternoon. And anytime I tag a shark, it's an exhilarating experience.
So I never bring you sighting numbers, Greg, because they're always a little confusing. Sharktivity app has some confirmed, some unconfirmed. And I'm never sure if what seems like a whole bunch of sharks actually isn't. So the buzz is that there have been a lot of sharks in the region. You're saying actually not so many.
We're pretty much on average. You know, we expect May and June to be very, very slow, and they were. And then July is a pivotal month. You know, if it warms up quickly in July, we start seeing the numbers build, and we're in that transitional phase right now. But realize there are a lot of eyes on the water. There's now ecotours on the water every day. There are eyes in the sky, at least three planes in the air yesterday. And we have our real-time receivers operating. All those sources of information send notifications out. And when those notifications go out, it appears like there's sharks everywhere.
And the real-time receivers refer to the receivers on the sharks that you've tagged, like the one you did yesterday.
Exactly. Anytime that shark now swims within the range of one of our live receivers, it will be reported to lifeguards and to Sharktivity. So it really, you could have a handful of sharks swimming around these receivers, seeming like there's 50 out there and there's only a few.
Here's the other part that we wanted to talk to you about, which is safety. Now, we've talked in the past before about what is and is not realistic in terms of concerns when it comes to sharks, shark sightings, shark attacks. Fortunately, they don't happen that often, but awfully, the last deadly shark attack in Massachusetts was off the Cape in 18. What do we look for to recognize sharks if we're in the water? Let's just start there.
Well, if we're in the water and we see a shark, I absolutely suggest you slowly leave the water. Absolutely. But in most cases, people don't see a shark when they're at sea level and they're in the water. These sharks that I'm talking about, these white sharks along the Outer Cape primarily, and that's an important point. Sharks are not equally distributed throughout the Atlantic Ocean and along our coastlines. There are some areas that where people might be slightly more vulnerable than other areas. And I would consider the Outer Cape to be one of those regions where sharks are hunting seals. And if you're going to swim there, be very cognizant of their presence. So my advice is not go in over your waist if you're along the Outer Cape where these sharks are hunting seals.
And you said back away very carefully. Is that because if you splash around too much, the shark might mistake you for a seal?
Exactly. Yeah, you don't want to panic, splash, you know, do anything that create the kind of give the shark some indication that you are a seal trying to elude it. Simply back out of the water and to say, you know, get out of harm's way.
So does that mean one can't be on a boogie board or a raft or a surfboard safely this time of year in the Outer Cape now?
That's a really good question, because we have a large group of folks who continue to use all those things along the Outer Cape. And as we know, there is not a high frequency of attacks occurring. These kinds of activities are perfectly fine. But if you're concerned and afraid of the presence of these animals and you think you might, you know, be vulnerable, and it's a personal decision, I've always said that, then perhaps, you know, you don't want to be out there in deep water mimicking a potential prey item, you know, but people still do it. And every day, we don't have these attacks.
So that is good news. And I want to continue to keep that in focus. We've covered so much over the last few years, Greg, about the way everything from Jaws to other, you know, local legends have dialed up our concern for this conserved animal. And I want to be respectful of that. We are having a conversation today about what to do if you do, in one of those rare situations, encounter a scary animal and a dangerous animal. So should one find oneself in proximity, first thing is to back away. Are there any other things you should do to protect yourself from a shark bite if you're unfortunate enough to be close?
If you're close and you feel threatened, let's say you're out in deep water in an area where there is a shark and you feel threatened, always keep your eyes on that animal and again, react very, very calmly. You know, do not panic. And that's key. And it's hard to do because you're going to be immediately frightened by the presence of a shark. It might not even be a harmful shark, but nonetheless, be calm and slowly get to safety, whether it be a nearby boat or the shoreline. But my first recommendation to folks is don't put yourselves in that position in specific areas. And again, I'll say the Outer Cape, where there's plenty of seals and the numbers of sharks are increasing to feed on those seals, is one of those areas.
If you're in a boat, are you fairly safe if there's a shark, whether it's a tiger shark or it's a great white shark or something smaller swimming around?
Absolutely. If you're on a boat, in a vessel of any kind, you're going to be perfectly safe. We do it in a small boat every day. We're very, very close to white sharks and we're not threatened.
So I was looking at some video also that came through the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, and I'm watching this shark underwater swim. And the thing that blows my mind about it, Greg, is how little it's moving and how fast it's going. They're kind of miracles of design.
Yeah, they're amazing animals. Their body is mostly muscle. And probably 90% of the time, they are moving very, very slowly. Okay, they're not in any rush. It's that fraction of the time when they're in hot pursuit of a potential prey item, they can accelerate using that muscle mass to speeds in excess of 20 miles an hour. And so you'll see a white shark swimming along like you did, Tiziana, and you'll see it relaxing and taking it easy. But when it turns on the afterburners, it is capable of incredible power and speed. And it spends, however, the bulk of its time not burning up that energy.
One of the things that I noticed in watching the video of you tag a shark, that shout of yours, it's full of joy, but forgive me for sort of projecting. I heard great respect and affection there, too. Why do you love these creatures so much?
Well, as you said, I think they're miracles of evolution. They've persisted for millions and millions of years, and they're so well adapted to the ocean environment. They're such efficient predators, and they're long-lived. We've estimated that these sharks can live in excess of 70 years. Each of these individuals is unique in many ways. They have different behavioral traits. I just think it's a magnificent creature that is capable as a top predator of really regulating the marine ecosystem. So I'm just always in awe. So whether I'm tagging number 290 or number one, I'm always excited because I'm basically living a childhood dream.
And so now we're in shark season. Your research is underway. You've tagged your first. What are you most hoping for this season?
Well, we always hope to get our tag numbers up. The more we tag, the more we learn, and we do it one shark at a time. If you and I speak in 3 or 4 months and I've only tagged 5 sharks, so be it. It's the way it was. But we're always trying to produce new information and learn from these animals. And, you know, any revelation, however small it is significant for us. And the really the emphasis of our work over the last few years has been to try to produce information, not only to conserve the species, but to also help augment public safety, to give information to the swimming public, to public safety officials that'll help them avoid these animals, avoid being hurt, and also give them great respect for the sharks that, like I have.
Greg Skomel is with the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Tiziana. Always a pleasure.
So, what about encountering the wild on land instead of at sea? Joining us for more good tips and tricks for what to do if you see anything from a bear or a coyote, even a wild turkey, we are joined in the studio by Renata Pomponi. She is the Senior Regional Director of Massachusetts Audubon Society's Metro Boston region. Welcome back, Renata.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to share some stories and information about wildlife encounters.
We're looking forward to it. Did you learn anything about sharks just now from Greg Skomel?
I learned that I am probably only going to swim at lifeguarded beaches on the Cape this summer.
You learned not to put yourself in that situation. All right, so let's talk about some other situations we can find ourselves in on land. And I want to start with bears, right? 4,500 estimated black bears in Massachusetts, and their numbers are both growing and expanding eastward. Do we know why?
Well, I think it's two things. One is Massachusetts has been great in protecting wild areas and having laws that protect wild animals. But also, we have been expanding our own development. We've been taking the areas that out west and central Mass that used to be large stretches of forest and having housing development, other development going on there. So we're kind of pushing them into more frequent encounters with human areas.
So here's the warning sound. That sound came from the National Park Service. It's a black bear in a tree. Is that what you would hear? And what should listeners know about a bear who's in this position? So you come along, it's up there, you're down here. What do you do?
Well, first of all, there are probably bears out there that you're not going to hear, and they are aware of you and probably staying away, which is what we would all want.
And they do, in general, try to stay away?
In general, yes. You know, humans are not a natural part of their environment, and they are not looking to engage with us unless they feel threatened. If they're up in a tree, that's a safe place for them. I would go with the, you know, choose another path, back slowly away.
And is that the case? Is it the case, Renata? I think that I recall that one takes a different approach with black bears than with brown bears, and that black bears are the one where you do you. There's no wah to scare them away. You just walk away.
Well, I guess the good thing for us in remembering all this about bears in the moment when you find one is that there are no brown bears, grizzlies in Massachusetts at
good,
all.
You're only going to see. I don't think I remember the difference.
You're only going to see the black bear. And if the bear is not aware of you or not engaging with you, slowly backing away is a great way to deal with it.
All right. So we are talking with Renata Pomponi, who's the Senior Regional Director for the Metro Boston region for the Massachusetts Audubon Society. We just finished with bears. Going to talk a little bit about coyotes now, which really a thing. So we reached out to our texting group. If you want to join our texting group, you can text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's text Boston to 617-766-0382 to get started. So Kay in Marblehead wrote us and said, quote, on a bike ride through Nahant a couple of weeks ago, a coyote ran right by me. At first, I thought it was a dog, but it hit me quickly. He, she looked at me. I looked at him, her, and then I rode away like crazy, end quote. The state estimates at least 10,000 coyotes in Massachusetts. Are you going to encounter them everywhere, anywhere?
Coyotes are now pretty much everywhere in Massachusetts, urban areas as well as rural, except for the islands. You really will see them just about anywhere.
All right, so let's hear what a coyote sounds like. Yeah, that is some hardcore Disney sound right there, meaning that it makes me think of all those movies where packs of things attack. You know, they're not a joke. They're not little foxes. They're pretty big. Males can be up to about 35 pounds. What kind of threat do coyotes pose to people, if any?
So coyotes are really just looking for the same thing all animals are. They're looking for shelter. They're looking for food. So as their more wild habitats have become developed, they're going to be moving into more human areas. They're going to find easy sources of food, like our trash cans, our bird feeders. And so that's where they're going to be attracted to. And if they find a good food source like that, they'll be coming back to it. So the best thing you can do if you don't want to encounter coyotes around your house is to keep those food sources locked up. Don't feed your pets outside. Put a pause on your bird feeder if you do notice coyotes around. They're going to move on and try to find easier food sources. It's also important never to feed wild animals. It's not good for them. It's also not good for the next person who encounters that coyote who thinks that, oh, here's a person I'm associating that with food.
So I'm going to tell you a story here, Renata. So you said don't have food out, keep it in. In our area where I live, lots and lots of rabbits, which means that we get lots and lots of coyotes. I see them regularly in my neighborhood. A couple of months ago in the evening, my husband's out front with our little dog, Ernie, and standing 5 feet away, 10 feet away from Ernie, and out of nowhere comes a coyote and snatches Ernie 10 feet from my husband. Now, he screams, Ernie wiggles, coyote drops him, he was okay. But when you're at that level of encounter, does anything need to change, or what changes do we need to make, or is that just a freak thing and I happened to have the experience?
Well, I think it's something that could be getting more common, but it is still pretty rare. We encourage people, if they're out on trails, to walk their dogs in a leash for that very reason. So you can scoop up your pet. You can keep your dog from running after an animal, coyote or other. But you can also make your own mass mm-hmm. to the animal look bigger. That's the kind of encounter I think, did the exactly right thing with Ernie. Try to pick him up, wave your arms, yell, bang pots and pans if you're near your house and you want to scare away the animal. That's probably the best way to handle it.
And we hear lots of people talk about the raccoons they encounter, you know, in a trash barrel or in their yard. And of course, there's some confusion about, wait, when is it normal to see a raccoon? When is it not normal to see a raccoon? How would I know if that raccoon is rabid, for example? So, A, when is it normal and not normal to see a raccoon? And B, how do you recognize concerns about rabies or signs of rabies in any wildlife you might encounter in your, you know, your yard or your community or on a walk?
Yeah, a lot of the animals we've been talking about are typically more active at night, and we typically think of raccoons as being kind of nocturnal feeders. I have seen raccoons out during the day in Cambridge wandering around. I think sometimes if they have young nearby, they might be looking, you know, foraging or, you know, getting their own meal while they're taking care of the babies. So it's not totally a concern to think that animal shouldn't be out during the daytime. But if they look like they're stumbling, if they look like they're sick, you know, the classic frothing at the mouth, then that's when you really need to be concerned about it and report it to your local animal control.
So in general, when an animal looks unwell, it's frothing, it's stumbling, it seems confused, those are good signs that perhaps it's rabid?
Yes, or has some, there's other kinds of illnesses, injuries that can make an animal act that way. And then just in general, one note on raccoons that's really important is if they happen to get into your garbage can and you're going to clean up the mess the next day, it's always great to wear gloves with those animals because their feces and other saliva, things like that, can be very harmful to humans. So you just want to wash your hands, be really clean when you deal with anything that's been touched by a wild animal.
Okay, so last one, you walk outside out of your apartment or out of some building and you smell that smell of a skunk. What happens if you get hit spot on? How does one de-skunk oneself or an animal like a pet?
Well, first I got to tell you, skunks are great because they give us warning signals before
Indeed,
they do
they
this.
Do.
They will pat their paws, they'll turn around and wave their tail, and that's what's going to happen before that smell hits you. Counter to all the recommendations about slowly backing away, you can turn and run from a skunk. It's
okay.
Not going to follow you. It's not going to attack you. I know that, you know, the classic tomato juice is what people hear about for a pet. If you get sprayed, it's really that kind of acid vinegar effect that will neutralize the odor. But I think a lot of it just has to, you got to wait for it to wear off.
Ugh, okay. Renata Pomponi is Senior Regional Director for the Metro Boston Region from the Massachusetts Audubon Society, helping us encounter wildlife and not get, you know, stung or stunk or anything like that. Thank you so much, Renata. It was fun.
Thank you so much.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles with Maya Schwader. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for joining us today. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.